This is the Poet and the Poem from the studios of the Library of Congress. I am Grace Cavalieri. Our poet is Nancy Arbuthnot, who is a professor emeritus at the United States Naval Academy, and she's going to read an opening poem.
I would like to read from my book about animal sculptures in Washington. And this, I thought, was appropriate these days because there's a little irony in here, as you'll see. It's called Yak. Shaggy majesty of hair and horns and high humped back. The wild yak wanders Tibet's cold plateaus, its long, low grunt resounding far, unanswered here in Washington, which lacks yaks.
That's Nancy Arbuthnot. And I'm glad you read that opening poem, because I was looking at a few of your books and I saw that you organized some according to themes. This one is about sculptures of animals in Washington. Then you have a book which is organized with biblical texts for each poem. Do you do that because the construct inspires the poem? If you have a passage from Luke, is that what inspires the poem? Is that why you arrange it that way?
Actually, I think most of my poems are just individual poems, and then like a many in Blue Rhapsodies, which are about my childhood in part, I've been working on or have had in some kind of box or old computer or on a computer disk for 30 years. And just in the past few years, after I've not been teaching for a while full time, I've had time to put them together and organize them. So yes, I do. I guess once I start looking at them, I think in terms of themes. And now my next book is, I think actually my next two books are all thematic in a way.
What are those themes?
Well, the working title, although I know it's very harsh, is called The Art of Rape. So it's about the art of masterpieces of art that deal with sexual violation somehow. And most of the white male artists depict these scenes often as seduction scenes. So anyway, that's where I start off on that book, and I've just been going rather wild with it. So, and then I bring my own sort of personal experiences and knowledge of other people's experiences to bear on the poems and on the paintings of long ago and bring them into the contemporary world.
Well, a few of your books are out already, and one is American Artists of World War II?
Yes.
And From Where the Wind Blows. Then we have The Wild Washington we heard from, Blue Rhapsodies. So you're pretty productive. I want to talk about Blue Rhapsodies because, first of all, when you say Professor Emerita at the Academy, why do you say at? Is it because once you're a professor, you're always a professor there?
I think so. I'm not actually sure exactly how you do it. Sometimes I just put a comma there, but...
But I do know that there's a meaning for that, because it's
right.
Like once you are bonded to the Academy, mm-hmm. you are part of that great long tradition, the United States Naval Academy in Annapolis, Maryland. And you were a Navy child, so you followed that path from infancy to retirement. Not too long ago. Tell me what it was like being a Navy child.
First, let me just say, yes, I was almost forced to apply to the Naval Academy as a professor because there was a position in creative writing. And my father had wanted my older brother to go, and he lasted a year there. And then he wanted, when they opened it up to women, my sisters to go. I was too old to have gone to the Naval Academy, but when the position as professor opened up and I got it, he was, of course, delighted. So being
because
there,
he was a naval aviator.
He was a naval aviator.
A fighter pilot, a cougar
mm-hmm.
pilot.
Yeah, yeah.
And I know he was at the Bay of Tonkin, and so was my husband.
Yes, well, he wasn't there too long. He was mostly in the Mediterranean and then the Western Pacific, traveling around on the boats, but he didn't stay really in Vietnam in the Gulf of Tonkin.
Well, let me start at the beginning. What did it feel like to know you were part of this elegant tradition and very difficult one. As a child, how many times did you move?
I think I went to 13 different schools, and we moved constantly. I haven't actually added them all up, but up and down the coast of California, back and forth across the United States, mostly driving with four or five, six, seven kids in the car.
When you look at it, would you do it again? I mean, is it a great thing,
yes,
or are you maimed by something?
No, not at all. I don't think so. I think I really grew through that experience. And because I had a large family and lots of younger sisters, particularly, always someone to care for, but always also someone to play with, I had a group of friends. So it didn't really matter that much that I went to a new school and knew nobody, which is kind of terrifying.
You know, I'm so glad you said that because, as you know, I was a Navy wife for 25 years, and I moved so many times with four children, and I began to know that there was no outside world, in a way. The inside world of spirit was the glue, and that once you kept that intact, you could move it anywhere.
Yes.
But I'm so glad to hear you say that you actually enjoyed the life.
I did. I liked going to new places, and especially when I got older as a teenager, even though it was hard, I also felt like if I made mistakes, I could begin again. I could be a perfect slate. And that was wonderful.
Oh, that's a new thought I hadn't entertained. I just have another personal question. The love you have for your father, which is evidenced in this book, Blue Rhapsodies, was it partly because he was gone so much? Did that make it more acute?
Probably. My youngest sisters grew up with my father from the age of like 4 or 5 when he was out of the Navy. So they grew up in one house in one place here in Chevy Chase, Maryland. I had a totally different relationship. Yes, I kind of idolized him. My father could do everything and anything. If you tried to paint a picture, he would actually have talked, he would talk about how he painted pictures, and he would show you when he would do a good picture. If he wanted to take you on a walk, he would ask you about the trees. He knew everything about trees.
Were you the oldest of the
girls? I was the oldest girl. My brother was older.
So you had, there were seven children,
right,
and there were five girl siblings under you.
Yes.
You're the oldest girl.
Yes. Yes.
Did he favor you because of that? And he took you scuba diving.
Yes. That's because he liked to scuba dive and he liked to show off his family. And I was old enough to go with him at age 8 when he took me and left me out in the ocean alone while he went diving down below. I was on the top.
Well, how
swimming.
Many months was he away? The longest my husband was away was 9.
Yes, but it was, that's the same thing
but
with my dad.
9 months. Mm-hmm. But my husband was on 9 carriers. So it was quite a... the first 10 years were quite different for me. I was alone quite a bit. So I loved this book.
Oh, thank you,
because
Grace.
It was like coming home to something that I thought, there's nothing like it, really. It's the only book I know where a Navy child tells exactly her heart, the way her mother smelled, the way their parents aged together. Let us hear a good portion. Give us 3 from
okay.
the book.
Okay.
Nancy Arbuthnot.
I'll read first one about my father as a fighter pilot, and I was about 8 years old at the time. The F-38 Demon fighter peels from the airstrip, whirling up desert dust. Mach 2, 2.2, plane shuddering, red light flashing. My father, pulse never quickening, calls Mayday, Mayday into the radio, shuts down the engine. Dead stick lands. Next day for show and tell, I hold up the front page photo. Asbestos-clad emergency crew racing toward the aviator, stepping smiling from the swept-wing Widowmaker. All of us Navy brats love the taste of danger, dare each other to scale the barbed wire fence of the firing range, linger in surf as lifeguards raise red flags and shrill whistles. Shark! All out. Even now I feel the thrill of whining bullets, fins slicing water, my father laughing as my mother at the dressing table brushes her hair for the O Club dance, tightens her lips, slashes them crimson.
That's the voice of Nancy Arbuthnot with the book Blue Rhapsodies. We're going to hear a couple more.
So I did not have only love for my father. I was a little bit afraid of him. I was antagonistic often towards him. I felt, no, I was by no means a favorite daughter. It was hard to tell with my parents, though, that any of us was a favorite. But my dad really challenged me to do things that I didn't want to do, and that was sometimes difficult. This one is called Rebel Days. I'm 14 years old in McLean, Virginia, my dad's last duty station at the Pentagon. Even daughters should learn to hunt, Dad believes. So in pre-dawn quiet, we pull on camouflage, drive dark roads to the river. Sky flaming orange, we cross rutted fields, 20-gauge shotgun cracked, open, barrel down, safety catch, always on. In the blind, we slide shells into barrels, scan the horizon for the wavering V of geese in flight. At first honk, Dad raises his wooden call, "Urk, urk." Geese circle, wings set to land. "Take 'em," Dad cries. I leap up, fumble with the safety. Dad wings a loner rising late, sends me out to the hissing stubble. Just twist the neck until it snaps.
Nancy, you're such a gentle soul with such a rugged beginning. And another.
Well, just about the gentle soul, I will say that at one time I had a little interaction with a midshipman at the Naval Academy, and he threw a glove down. He was going out on official watch duty, and he was really mad at me for somehow I had graded his paper lower than he thought I should. He threw a glove down, and one of the other professors came out of his office and saw this young man storming away, and he said, "Nancy, I know you've got an iron fist under that velvet glove of yours." So, yes, I think my father taught me that there are all kinds of adversities, and you've just got to brace yourself and be strong. So, let me read one about the Naval Academy. Actually, and this is, if you've been to the Naval Academy in Annapolis, you know it's decorated with many, many monuments, not too many statues, which was on purpose. And I had my students try to engage with where they were, especially the plebes. They didn't always want to be at the Naval Academy.
Tell us what a plebe is.
A plebe is a freshman. So they come in right after the 4th of July, right after Independence Day. At least that used to be the time that they would be inducted into the Naval Academy. And right away they get their hair shorn. They get stripped of their identity. They get an alpha code, a number instead of a name. And so when they first start, then they start classes in the fall, and they're a little bit used to things by that time, but still it's tough. They aren't allowed outside the academy except for very limited liberty, as they call it, or leave. So I thought, okay, how can I engage them with where they are, get them to really feel a part of where they are? And partly because I also, when we lived here in the D.C. area, when I was a teenager going to high school, I went to the academy often with my father, met all his academy friends. So I knew the great bonds that the academy could forge among people. So one thing that I had my students do is write about the monuments in the yard, and I ended up writing about it too, and I put a book together with their poems and mine and descriptions of the monument. This is one of the first actual monuments in the U.S. It's called the Tripoli Monument, and it's about the Barbary Coast Wars in the northern part of Africa. This one is about a tour to the North Pole. I'm sorry. The federal government at the time in the 1890s sent naval officers in charge of ships that were of scientific expedition ships. So the naval captain was in command, or lieutenant even sometimes. And this trip was sent from San Francisco, this ship, the Jeannette, was sent from San Francisco to the Arctic to try and find a path through the North Pole so there would be easier access from coast to coast. Anyway, they did not survive, most of them, and it's a very dramatic story.
Did they send them out knowing they would not survive?
No. They thought, I mean, the Swedes were sending out people to the South Pole.
The first of this kind, though. So they knew the difficulties.
They knew the difficulty, and they thought they had prepared. And as I learned from the Navy, you have, you know, three redundancies, so you always prepare three different ways for something to go wrong and to be able to write it. And they had a way to escape. Their ship, the Jeannette, got trapped in ice for 18 months. And the captain was just wonderful at keeping the morale up among his troops. But then it finally was trapped in ice, so he sent the crew off in three different small boats. This one is from a little group of poems called A Tour of the Yard. The Yard is the Naval Academy campus. And this monument is a huge cross, a granite cross that looks like it has ice dripping from it. Marble ice drips from the marble cross. Memorial to officers and crew lost in the expedition to the pole. Failed experiment that shows how hopelessness can be faced with hope. Day after ice-bound day, taking soundings, tossing footballs, planning trips to Paris, France, and naming the sled, the ship now sunk, nil desideratum, never despair.
Nancy Arbuthnot from Blue Rhapsodies. I'm Grace Cavalieri. We're in the studios at the Library of Congress. I want to talk about teaching these midshipmen because I believe, from an outsider's view, it looks like very oppressed. They are forced to, you know, scrub the hall with a toothbrush sometimes. They are asked to memorize all the menus when they're plebes. And if you're stopped by an upperclassman, you have to name all the food that is going to be served. There are incredible ways of disciplining you. And the idea is kind of an old-fashioned one, that through adversity comes strength and character. Through discipline, you become a disciple to order. But as a teacher of poetry, they come in there, and then what kind of armor do you have to peel away? Or isn't that the case?
That is a really good question. I never really asked that. I just thought I need to connect with them somehow, and I tried different ways, and sometimes they were total failures, and I could feel a wall going up against me. I had one class, it was like that. I could not wait for that semester to be over.
What did that do to your spirit? And why was that? Why did they take poetry in the first place? Do they need the three credits?
Right. They need credits. There are English majors, but there's also a requirement that midshipmen, the plebes particularly, take 1 year of English
and classes. Humanities. And humanities?
They take history also. And
that's not enough humanities, but
it's a start. It's more than a lot of schools actually do now. So even as English majors, they graduate with a BS degree because they've gotten all the electrical
engineering
requirements
when they come out.
Right.
And so can you think that sometimes a poem lodged inside of a person, or that they got it?
Yes. Every once in a while, I used to get emails from students who had graduated, and they would say something like, or they would even come back and stop by and see me in my office. They'd say, I'm really glad you gave us, you know, these things to read, and I took my book of short stories with me on my first cruise, and when I didn't have watch, when I didn't have anything to do, I had just enough time I could read a short story and really be in another world for a while. Would be too long, but a short story was great.
Well, what a contribution. That is the reward, isn't it? that is the reward. Did you get some that were able to write creatively?
Oh, yes. I had some fabulous writers. In fact, some of the midshipmen go on and become speechwriters. And in one case, one became a speechwriter for president. I don't remember.
But poetry is different.
But poetry is different.
Being a woman and a civilian, I mean, do you think that the midshipmen consider the civilians more merciful as instructors? Or was it just your field that you were teaching that was more merciful?
I think yes. I think they really enjoyed being able to come to English class and delve into thoughts and feelings that they otherwise weren't able to express at all.
And one confided in you that he felt suicidal and
yes.
didn't dare tell his superiors because
right.
you don't want that on your record.
Right.
And
right.
you might have had that more than once, someone who came with something personal.
Yes, I had several people who, for some reason, confessed things to me. They were gay. They had, you know, they didn't want to be at the academy. They were, maybe they were even transgender. They didn't even have a word for it at the time. They didn't know how to express it. But I had a few women who said they did not want to be women.
Yes. And did you listen?
Yes. Sometimes I just listened, but I tried to get them to get other people to listen to them, chaplains or professional therapists, but they refused. So
well, I felt
I had to listen.
Of course you did. Poetry heals because it's about the wound. I mean, all art is a context for the wound. So I think that is a beautiful thing that you offered. Let's hear more from Blue Rhapsodies, Poems of a Navy Life. And now we're talking to a professor emerita from the United States Naval Academy, Nancy Arbuthnot.
So I would like to read a poem called Office Hours about a midshipman who comes in to talk to me about, to show me his poems, but also to talk to me about some things that he's going through. In my green swivel chair, beside the bookcase of slim volumes of contemporary poets, Ashbery to Zimmer, dog-eared, stained, a few spine-cracked, a favorite signed, Transformations by Sexton at the Library of Congress just before the end, dressed in black, hair slashing her sharp crow face. Under the lamp's glow, I run my hand over the black and white visage, the gaze direct, magnetic, fan through the pages, let my eyes fall. Oh, my friends, in the end, you will dance the fire dance in iron shoes. A knock at the door, a dutiful, permission to come aboard? An engineering major pulling poems from backpack, emptying eyes into mine. I'm having dreams. Suicide. My mind blanks. I'm not, I can't. Have you told the dean? He can't afford a negative report in his military jacket, he replies, then asks, can't I just talk to you? So each day I enter the classroom, dreading the empty seat, and each day after class, keeping him talking until he heaves out of his chair at last. Guess I better shove off to P-Raid. Abandoning me to Sexton again, gone down into the graveyard to talk back to bad old dreams.
Do you believe that you saw a psychological change in him? Because it sounds that the poem indicates that may be.
He did come back at the end of the semester, and the only time anyone's ever given me flowers, he gave me a bouquet of flowers.
And, you know,
and say, thank you for saving my life. I mean, it was a little overdramatic,
no,
I thought, but
take the compliment.
Okay.
That's not a small thing to save someone's life. Wow. The things you did to earn that money.
Yes.
Yeah. And had you taught in any other university before?
I have. As a graduate student, I taught at the University of Maryland, and I had classes in freshman composition and creative writing. And then at Virginia, University of Virginia, where I ended up getting my PhD, I taught creative writing, a contemporary poetry class, I think, and freshman composition always.
But quite different.
Very different.
Tone.
And when I got to the academy, I thought really the academy was the perfect place for me to teach because the students were so dedicated to giving themselves to something beyond themselves at Virginia and Maryland. I think it's a lot different now, and I've...
No, I think you've hit on something significant, because there is such a thing as an ideal, mm-hmm. and believing in a purpose, and that you don't get from every grad student.
Yes.
Yeah. So that's very interesting, and I love this book a lot, and want to hear more.
Oh, thank you. So I did have a rough time sometimes at the academy. And I had three children. My husband was a policeman in D.C. And during the crack cocaine epidemic in the late 80s, early 90s, he was gone a lot, in part because there's so much administrative stuff you have to do. He was a lieutenant and a captain, so he was not a patrol officer out there when we had children, but he wasn't home a lot. So I had the care of these three children and living in D.C., trying to get to the Annapolis Naval Academy for morning classes, 8 o'clock in the morning. I'd race home at 3:30 so that I could pick them up from daycare or the school where they were, the little nursery school. And it got to be too much, so I asked for a leave of absence, and then I ended up liking that time off, and I managed to partner with another novelist at the Academy, wonderful writer, and we shared a job for many years. So I worked.
How many years were you there?
I was there for 29 years.
So your children grew up.
So they grew up, yes, and they often came to office hours with me if I was not teaching that day. There was a day when actually my au pair, we tried all different kinds of childcare arrangements. I thought, finally, I have someone live in with me, and then I can leave early in the morning. It won't be a problem. Well, she went into a catatonic fit. She had serious psychological problems, and I came back one day just not knowing, actually, the house was open. It was silent. I went room to room. I went up first flight of stairs and then up into the attic, just not letting myself think about what might happen or what might have happened. And then I heard little sounds, crying and yelling. I noticed my children's voices. I went to the attic window. There they were. Lika, the au pair, was holding the baby in her arms. The baby was slipping down. Margaret and Charles, who were like 3 and 4 years old, were throwing little pebbles at Lika. So I went running downstairs, grabbed the baby, brought everyone in the house. Lika sat down and didn't move for hours and hours. So that's when and the next day, my husband, I had no backup. At that point, Lika was actually at the emergency room. I had to go teach my class, so I parceled out the two older kids to friends, took the baby with me. And
you took the baby to the academy.
Yeah, took the baby to the academy in the classroom.
What are you complaining about? Just a normal day for a working mother. And that's interesting. I didn't know that your husband was a police officer, which has its own Navy overtones,
right,
doesn't it?
Right, yes.
Let's hear more from Blue Rhapsodies.
So actually, I'll read you something called Paper Engineers. And the poems about the Naval Academy, about teaching there, I found, you know, a lot of times I just admired my students so much. And this was one of the occasions. I was teaching The Scarlet Letter. I just reread that and I thought, oh my goodness, how could I have taught that? But it is such a wonderful book. And I wanted to teach mostly my males in the class. There were very few women when I started off teaching. I wanted to give them the perspective of a woman who was
an adulterer,
ostracized from society.
But now, you think that was so bold at the time? It would be banned now, wouldn't it?
Oh,
in Florida.
Gosh, probably.
What a shocking thing. So have you written about that?
So I wrote something called Paper Engineers.
Did the Academy tell you what to teach? Or did you
choose
your...
No, we can choose our own. We're supposed to teach poetry and the novel in the spring, and we always had there was a play group at the Academy, a theater group, and they presented a play in the fall, so we were supposed to teach
plays in the fall. That's quite liberal. I'm surprised.
It's different at, say, West Point, which has a very strict curriculum. It's interesting and
better.
It can be a powerful.
And better.
Mm-hmm. But this one, is about the midshipman dealing with my son and daughter. I guess I brought both of them to the academy. So my son, who's about 3, and my daughter was a few months old. And there's some quotes from the Scarlet Letter, and there are some names of paper gliders. So I hope you can identify those as I read. Lacking the third redundancy expected in military operations, police husband sole backup for home crises, expediting to a murder in far southeast, I stand vigilant at the podium while Annie naps in her stroller and Charles crawls up and down the carpeted steps. The mids jot down thoughts on the scarlet letter with their sharp mechanical pencils. Charles whimpers, and a sudden fleet of paper gliders zooms beyond my diligence. The dart and swoop, lightning and rapier, wings stenciled with Pearl's Price, Hester's Art, Dimmesdale's Scarred Heart. One mid stoops to Annie, sleeping, to switch her pink Velcro sneakers to the correct feet.
Oh, that is so touching. Oh, that is so... And you put the shoes on the wrong feet.
Yes, I was in such a rush. And oh, my goodness.
Let us have a final poem.
Thank you. So Blue World is about 9/11. And some of my students actually came to the academy because of 9/11. They grew up in New Jersey or New York, and in eighth grade, they saw the Twin Towers falling, and they decided at that moment that they were going to go to the Naval Academy. And that's pretty much when you've got to start thinking about it, because there's so much preparation you have to do to be finally accepted at the
academy.
That's
what Kamal Harris says. Her husband entered the military after that.
Oh, okay.
Yes, it inspired many people.
Yes, yes. So I was sitting in my office. I was going to be teaching Beowulf. And Beowulf, in part, the setting is this hall, this fortress area. Everybody's pretty safe in the hall. They're drinking and careening, but there is danger in the outside world. And this was, early 2000s. Nothing was going on in the world. We were at peace. Some of the naval officers who taught at the academy in the English department, we always had several, were going off after their two-year tour. They were going to go off to Italy to work at a naval station and teach tennis. So I had, no idea of how to teach this poem about being so... so put upon by this dramatically dangerous outside world. So, and everyone remembers, who was alive then remembers the color of the sky. And since I was teaching Beowulf, I tried, and in a lot of the poems, I try and use some of the poetic forms. So this one uses the alliteration and the double... It's called a hemistich line. It's divided, one line divided into two, with two accents on the first half of the line and one accent on the second. So I don't always do that, but that's
glad our audience is a little more hip.
Nobody needs to know that, but the alliteration is what's important. An azure ache out my office window, crystal clear September sky. I turn aside to ponder poetry, put on its modgathonk, reconcile this realm of bloodlust rampant, instinct unleashed, the world of Beowulf, with ours so safe, secure, I step out for class. to the secretary in tears, taking my hand, tugging me towards the TV down the hall, the Pentagon pulsing poisonous flames, the Twin Towers falling time after time. Dozing over Beowulf a decade on, I careen reckless down cloistered halls, door after locked door, dooming me to armed assailants intent on disaster. Nancy, Nancy, my husband calls my name, waking me to morning, majestic at the window, beautiful, blue, brutal, alive.
May we talk about that for a moment? I can't make it final. Say again the reason that there are two columns of poetry. What is that called?
The lines are called hemi-stitch. So
how do you spell
half, it? H-E-M-I, like hemi, like hemisphere. So half of a line.
Okay. So we have two columns of poems. And when you read it across, that's the way you wrote it, right?
Right.
Wrote it across, and there's a space between the phrases. But when you read it down, it also makes a poem. And so I don't know if you realize that it always happens that way, but why don't you just read the second column to me out my office window and see what happens?
Okay. I never thought of that.
It works.
Out my office window, I turn aside, put on its Modgethunk of bloodlust rampant. With hours, I step out for class, taking my hand, the TV down the hall, poisonous flames time after time. A decade on, down cloistered halls, dooming me, intent on disaster. My husband calls my name, majestic at the window, brutal, alive.
Well, it's not accurate,
quite, yeah.
But it's language poetry, isn't it? And now give us a small poem to take us away.
I would like to end with my poem from Spirit Hovering, which, as you had started off talking about, is a group of poems. There's a theme from the Bible, but it only started off by accident that way because I was at a writer's retreat, and I was going to be there for 10 days. I was on my third day, and it was so quiet and so peaceful. Everything was done for you. After 3 days, I had my project, which was translating poems of Les Femmes Lay, the poems in Waves Beyond Waves. I had finished translating them. I didn't know what to do. I had a Bible. I opened it up. I propped up my knees in the door. It was March, beautiful spring day. I looked at the cows across the road over on the hillside, and I just put my finger on a word and I started
thinking
about
what?
It.
Now I know why those Bibles are left in hotel rooms. Somebody someday will write a book. Let's have a poem.
So this is the last poem, and it's an envoy, which is a poem of goodbye, of sending something off into the world after Chaucer and a lot of other poets have little envoys. So I thought, well, I've written all these poems, now I have to do something with them. So, and it's also a poem about getting older and thinking about what comes next. On the edge of the circle, I peer toward the center where first I lay, startled by light. The once invisible periphery, now under my feet, the bright edge of one of many circles. From solitude go, little book, and where you are read, where I cannot follow, do good work.
The voice of Nancy Arbuthnot. And this is The Poet and the Poem from the Library of Congress in the studios of the library. The program is produced by Forest Woods Media Production, post-production by Mike Turpin, MET Studios. We wish to thank the Library of Congress for making the program possible. Funding is provided by the Sinipet Fund, the Rivada Foundation, the Anne Arundel Arts Council, Natalie Conivore, and Sandy Jackson Cohen. Our engineer is Mike Turpin, and I'm Grace Cavalieri.